said, "Get away from me. Hate me or whatever, I don't care as long as you leave me alone." But I'm a contrary person. On the streets, plenty of homeless folks had acted belligerent toward me and pushed me away. They didn't trust anybody. Why should they? That just made me more determined to get to know them. The loners usually had the best stories. They were the most interesting and the savviest about staying alive. Sam, a la boss, must have had some reason for bringing this kid to Valhalla. I wasn't going to let Fiero off the hook just because she had startling eyes, an impressive sweater vest, and a tendency to hit people. "What did you mean earlier?" I asked. "When you said, 'Call me she?'" "I'm gender fluid and transgender, idiot. Look it up if you need to, but it's not my job to educate." "That's not what I meant." "Oh, please, I saw your mouth hanging open." "Well, yeah. Maybe for a second. I was surprised. But..." I wasn't sure how to continue without sounding like even more of an idiot. The gender thing wasn't what surprised me. A huge percentage of the homeless teens I'd met had been assigned one gender at birth but identified as another, or they felt like the whole boy-girl binary didn't apply to them. They ended up on the streets because, shocker, their families didn't accept them. Nothing says tough love like kicking your non-heteronormative kid to the curb so they can experience abuse, drugs, high suicide rates, and constant physical danger. Thanks, Mom and Dad. What surprised me was the way I'd reacted to Alex. How fast my impression of her had slingshot and the kind of emotions that had stirred up. I wasn't sure I could put that into words without turning as red as Mallory Keene's hair. What I was saying, is when you were talking to the Raven, you mentioned you were worried you'd been messed up. What did you mean? Alex looked like I'd just offered her a huge wedge of Limburger cheese. Maybe I overreacted. I wasn't expecting to die today or get scooped up by some Valkyrie. That was Sam. She's okay. Alex shook her head. I don't forgive her. I got here and found out... Whatever. I'm dead. Immortal. I'll never age and never change. I thought that meant... Her voice frayed. It doesn't matter. I was pretty sure it mattered. I wanted to ask her about life in Midgard, why she had an outdoor atrium just like mine in her suite, why all the pottery, why she would want to put the mark of Loki next to her initials on her work. I wondered if her arrival was just a coincidence, or whether it had something to do with the mark on Uncle Randolph's face in the photo and our sudden urgent need to find Thor's hammer. On the other hand, I suspected that if I tried to ask her all that, she would turn into a mountain gorilla and rip my face off. Happily, I was spared that fate when a lindworm crash-landed in front of us. The monster hurtled out of the sky, flapping its ridiculous wings and roaring like a grizzly bear with a 100-watt amp. Trees cracked and splintered under its weight as it landed in our midst. "Arrgh!" Halfborn yelled, which was Old Norse for, "Holy crud, there's a dragon," just before the lindworm smacked him into the sky. Judging from the arc, Halfborn Gunderson was going to end up somewhere around floor 29, which would be a surprise to anyone relaxing on their balcony. TJ fired his rifle. Gunsmoke blossomed harmlessly against the dragon's chest. Mallory yelled a curse in Gaelic and charged. The lindworm ignored her and turned toward me. I should mention, lindworms are ugly, like if Freddy Krueger and a Walking Dead zombie had a child. That kind of ugly. Their faces have no flesh or hide, just a carapace of bone and exposed tendons, gleaming fangs, and dark sunken eye sockets. When the monster opened its maw, I could see straight down its rotten, meat-colored throat. Alex crouched, her hands fumbling for something at her belt. This isn't good. No kidding, my hand was so sweaty I could barely hold my sword. You go right, I'll go left, we'll flank it. No, I mean, that isn't just any dragon. That's Grimwolf, one of the ancient worms. I stared up into the monster's dark eye sockets. He did seem bigger than most of the lindworms I'd fought. But I was usually too busy dying to ask a dragon its age or name. How do you know? I asked. And why would anybody call a dragon Grimwolf? The lindworm hissed, filling the air with a scent like burning tires. Apparently he was sensitive about his name. Mallory stabbed at the dragon's legs, screaming more angrily the longer the lindworm ignored her. Are you two going to help? She called back at us. Or just stand there and chat? TJ stabbed at the monster with his bayonet. The point just bounced off the creature's ribs. Being a good soldier, TJ backed up and tried again. Alex tugged some sort of cord from her belt loops, a dull steel wire no thicker than a kite string with simple wooden dowels on either end for handles. Grimwolf is one of the dragons that live at the roots of Yggdrasil. He shouldn't be here. No one would be crazy enough to. Her face blanched, her expression hardening as if turning into lindworm bone. He sent it for me. He knows I'm here. Who? I demanded. What? Distract him, she ordered. She leaped into the nearest tree and began to climb. Even without turning into a gorilla, she could definitely move like one. I took a shaky breath. Distract him. Sure. The dragon snapped at Alex, biting off several tree branches. Alex moved fast, scampering higher up the trunk. But one or two more snaps and she'd be in Lindworm Lunchable. Meanwhile, Mallory and TJ were still hacking away at the creature's legs and belly, but they were having no luck convincing the dragon to eat them. It's only a practice battle, I told myself. Charge in there, Magnus. Get yourself killed like a pro. That was the whole point of daily combat. To learn to fight any foe, to overcome our fear of death, because on the day of Ragnarok, we need all the skill and courage we could muster. So why did I hesitate? First, I'm way better at healing than I am at fighting. Oh, and running away. I'm really good at that. Also, it's hard to charge straight to your own demise, even if you know it won't be permanent, especially if that demise involves large amounts of pain. The dragon snapped at Alex again, missing her rose high tops by an inch. As much as I hated dying, I hated even more seeing my comrades get killed. I screamed, "Frey!" and ran at the Lindworm. Just my luck. Grimwolf was happy to turn his attention to me. When it comes to drawing aggro from ancient monsters, I've got the golden touch. Mallory stumbled back out of my way, chucking one of her knives at the dragon's head. TJ also retreated, yelling, "All yours, buddy!" As far as encouraging words you might hear before an excruciating death go, those sucked pretty bad. I raised my shield and sword like the nice instructors had demonstrated in Viking 101. The dragon's mouth opened wide, revealing several extra rows of teeth, just in case the outer row of teeth didn't kill me dead enough. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Alex swaying at the top of the tree, a tense bundle of pink and green, ready to spring. I realized what she was planning. She wanted to jump onto the dragon's neck. That was such a stupid plan, it made me feel better about my own stupid way of dying. The dragon struck. I jabbed my sword upward, hoping to impale the monster's upper palate. Instead, a sudden pain blinded me. My face felt like it had been doused with industrial cleaning fluid. My knees buckled, which probably saved my life. The dragon bit empty air where my head had been a millisecond before. Somewhere to my left, Mallory screamed, "Get up, you fool!" I tried to blink away the pain. It only got worse. My nostrils filled with the stench of burning flesh. Grimwolf recovered his balance, snarling with irritation. Inside my head, a familiar voice said, "Come now, my friend, don't struggle." My vision doubled. I could still see the forest, the dragon looming over me, a small pink-green figure leaping toward the monster from the top of a tree. But there was another layer to reality, a gauzy white scene trying to burn its way through my corneas. I knelt in Uncle Randolph's study in the Chase family mansion in Back Bay. Standing over me was someone much worse than a Lindworm. Loki, the god of evil. He grinned down at me. "There we are. How nice." At the same time, the dragon Grimwolf struck again, opening his maw to devour me whole. Chapter 8. I am saved from certain death by being killed. I'd never existed in two places at once before. I decided I didn't like it. Through the pain, I was dimly aware of the fight in the forest. Grimwolf was about to bite me in half when suddenly his head bucked upward. Now Alex was straddling his neck, pulling her cord so tight around the dragon's throat that he thrashed and stuck out his forked black tongue. TJ and Mallory rushed in front of me, acting as a shield. They yelled at Grimwolf, waving their weapons and trying to hurt him back. I wanted to help them. I wanted to get to my feet or at least roll out of the way, but I was paralyzed, on my knees, trapped between Valhalla and my Uncle Randolph's study. "I told you, Randolph," Loki's voice dragged me further into the vision. "See? Blood is thicker than water. We have a solid connection." The hazy white scene resolved into full color. I knelt on the oriental carpet in front of Randolph's desk, sweating in the square of sunlight that was tinted green from the stained glass transom. The room smelled of lemon wood polish and burning meat. I was pretty sure the second odor was coming from my face. In front of me stood Loki, his tousled hair the color of fall foliage, his delicately sculpted face marred by acid burns across his nose and cheekbones and suture scars around his lips. He grinned and spread his arms in delight. "What do you think of my outfit?" He was wearing an emerald green tuxedo with a frilly maroon shirt, a paisley bow tie, and a matching cummerbund. If anything about the ensemble could be said to be matching. A price tag dangled from his left coat sleeve. I couldn't speak. I couldn't throw up as much as I wanted to. I couldn't even offer him a free consultation at Blitzen's Best. No, Loki's expression soured. I told you, Randolph. You should have bought me the canary yellow one, too. A strangled sound came from my throat. Magnus, said Uncle Randolph's voice. Don't listen! Loki extended his hand, the ends of his fingers smoking. He didn't touch me, but the pain across my face tripled, as though someone were branding me with an iron. I wanted to collapse, to beg Loki to stop, but I couldn't move. I realized I was seeing everything through my uncle's eyes. I was inhabiting his body, feeling what he was experiencing. Loki was using Randolph as some sort of agony-operated telephone to contact me. The pain eased, but Randolph's extra weight enveloped me like a lead wetsuit. My lungs rattled. My worn-out knees ached. I didn't like being an old man. Now, Randolph, Loki chided. Behave yourself. Magnus, I apologize about your uncle. Where was I? Oh, yes, your invitation. Meanwhile, in Valhalla, I remained paralyzed on the battlefield while the dragon Grimwolf staggered around, knocking down entire swaths of forest. One of the Lindworm's feet caught Mallory Keene, stomping her flat. TJ yelled and waved pieces of his now-broken rifle, trying to draw the monster's attention. Somehow, Alex Fierro managed to stay on the dragon's neck, tightening her cord as Grimwolf whipped back and forth. A wedding, Loki announced cheerfully. He held up a green invitation, then folded it and tucked it into Randolph's shirt pocket. 5 days from today. I apologize for the short notice, but I hope you can come, especially since it's up to you to bring the bride and the bride price. Otherwise, well, war, invasion, Ragnarok, etc. A wedding will be much more fun. Now let's see, how much has Samira told you? My skull constricted until it felt like my brain would come out of my sinus cavity. A ragged scream escaped my lips, but I wasn't sure if it was mine or Uncle Randolph's. From the dragon's neck, Alex yelled, "What's wrong with Magnus?" TJ ran to my side. "I don't know. His head is smoking. That's bad, right?" "Grab his sword," Alex pulled her cord tighter, causing black blood to trickle down the dragon's neck. "Get ready." "Oh, dear." Loki tapped me/Randolph on the nose. The pressure in my head subsided from blackout misery to moderate torture. "Samira hasn't shared. The poor thing is embarrassed, I suppose." "I understand. It's difficult for me, too, giving away my favorite daughter. They grow up so quickly." I tried to speak. I wanted to say, "Go away, you suck! Get out of my head and leave Samira alone!" It came out as, "Gah!" "No need to thank me," Loki said. "Neither of us wants Ragnarok to start just yet, eh? And I'm the only one who can help you." It wasn't an easy negotiation, but I can be very persuasive. The hammer in exchange for the bride. A one-time offer. I'll tell you more when you secure the bride price. "Now!" Alex yelled. She pulled her wire so hard the dragon arched his back, separating the segments of armored hide that protected his belly. TJ charged forward and thrust my practice sword into a soft spot below Grimwolf's heart. TJ rolled aside as the monster came down with his full weight, impaling himself. Alex leaped from the Lindworm's neck, her garrote dangling from one hand, slick with blood. "Was that Alex I heard?" Loki curled his scarred lip. "She's not invited to the wedding. She'll ruin everything. In fact," Loki's eyes gleamed with mischief, "give her a little present for me, will you?" My lungs tightened, even worse than when I was an asthmatic kid. My body began to superheat. I was in so much pain, my organs seemed to be dissolving into molecules, my skin glowing and steaming. Loki was turning my brain to fire, filling me with flashes of memories that weren't mine, centuries of anger and the need for revenge. I tried to push him out of my head. I tried to breathe. Alex Fierro stood over me, frowning. Her face and Loki's melded together. "Your friend is going to explode," Alex said, as if this were a perfectly normal thing that happened to people. TJ wiped his brow. "What exactly do you mean, explode?" "I mean Loki is channeling power through him," Alex said. "It's too much. Magnus will blow up, destroying most of this courtyard." I gritted my teeth. I managed one word. "Run!" "It won't help," Alex told me. "Don't worry, I've got a solution." She stepped forward and calmly wrapped her metal wire around my neck. I managed another word. "Wait!" "It's the only way to get him out of your head. Alex's brown and amber eyes were impossible to read. She winked at me. Or maybe that was Loki, his face glowing hazily just under Alex's skin. "See you soon, Magnus," said the god. Alex yanked both ends of her garrote and snuffed out my life. Chapter 9. Never take a bubble bath with the decapitated god. Someone please explain to me why I have to dream when I'm dead. There I was, floating in the darkness of non-existence, minding my own business, trying to get over the fact that I'd just been decapitated. Then, I got dropped into these weird, vivid nightmares. Really annoying. I found myself on a 30-foot yacht in the middle of a storm. The deck heaved. Waves crashed over the bow. Sheets of gray rain slammed into the wheelhouse windows. In the captain's chair sat Uncle Randolph, one hand clenching the wheel, the other strangling his radio handset. His yellow raincoat dripped puddles around his feet. His close-shaved head glistened with salt water. In front of him, the control board's monitors showed nothing but static. "Mayday!" he yelled into the handset like it was a stubborn dog refusing to do a trick. "Mayday, curse you! Mayday!" On the bench behind him, a woman and two young girls huddled together. I'd never known them in life, but I recognized them from photographs in Uncle Randolph's office. Perhaps because I had just been inside Randolph's head, I was able to pull their names from his memories. His wife, Caroline, and his daughters, Aubrey and Emma. Caroline sat in the middle, her dark brown hair plastered against her face, her arms around her daughter's shoulders. "It'll be all right," she told the girls. She glanced at Randolph with a silent accusation. "Why have you done this to us?" Aubrey, the youngest, had the Chase family's wavy blonde hair. Her head was bowed, her face set in deep concentration. She held a model of the yacht in her lap, trying to keep the toy level despite the 15-foot swells that rocked the wheelhouse, as if by doing so she could help her father. Emma was not as calm. She looked about 10, with dark hair like her mother's and sad, weary eyes like her father's. Somehow I knew that she'd been the most excited about this trip. She had insisted on coming along for Dad's big adventure, his search for a missing Viking sword that would finally prove his theories. Dad would be a hero. Randolph had not been able to refuse her. Now, though, Emma trembled with fear. The faint scent of urine told me that her bladder was not holding up under the stress. With each pitch of the boat, Emma shrieked and clutched a pendant to her chest, a runestone Randolph had given her for her last birthday. I couldn't see the symbol, but somehow I knew what it was. Othala, inheritance. Randolph saw Emma as his successor, the next great historian archaeologist of the family. "I'll bring us home," Randolph's voice cracked with despair. He had been so sure of his plans and confident about the weather. They would make an easy trip from the harbor. He had done extremely thorough research. He knew the Sword of Summer must lie at the bottom of Massachusetts Bay. He imagined himself making one quick dive. The old gods of Asgard would bless his efforts. He would bring the sword to the surface and lift its blade into the sunlight for the first time in 1,000 years. His family would be there to witness his triumph. Yet here they were, caught in a freak tempest, their yacht being thrown about like the toy in Aubrey's lap. The boat rolled to starboard. Emma screamed. A wall of water engulfed me. I surfaced in a different dream. My disembodied head bobbed up and down in a full bathtub that smelled of strawberry soap and mildewed washcloths. To my right floated a cheerful rubber ducky with worn-away eyes. To my left floated the not-so-cheerful head of the god Mimir. Seaweed and dead minnows swirled in his beard. Bubble bath foam dribbled from his eyes, ears, and nose. "I'm telling you," his voice echoed in the tiled bathroom, "you guys gotta go. And not just because I'm your boss. Destiny demands it." He wasn't talking to me. Next to the tub, sitting on a lovely avocado porcelain commode, was my friend Hearthstone, his shoulders slumped, his expression despondent. He wore his usual black leather coat and pants, a starched white shirt, and a polka-dotted scarf that looked like it had been cut from a Twister game mat. His spiky blonde hair was almost as pale as his face. Hearth gesticulated in sign language, so quickly and with such annoyance that I could only catch some of his words. "Too dangerous. Death. Protect this idiot." He pointed to Blitzen, who leaned against the sink with his arms crossed. The dwarf was as dapper as always in a walnut-colored three-piece suit that matched his skin tone, a bow tie as black as his beard, and a Frank Sinatra-style hat that somehow pulled the whole look together. "We have to go," Blitz insisted. "The kid needs us." I wanted to tell them how much I missed them, how much I wanted to see them, but also that they shouldn't risk their lives for me. Unfortunately, when I opened my mouth, the only thing that came out was a goldfish frantically wriggling its way to freedom. My face pitched forward into the bubbles. When I surfaced again, the dream had changed. I was still a disembodied head, but now it was floating in a massive open jar filled with pickles and vinegar. It was difficult to see through the greenish liquid in the curved glass, but I seemed to be on a bar. Neon drink ads glowed on the walls. Huge, hazy shapes sat hunched on the stools. Laughter and conversation sent ripples through the pickle juice. I didn't spend a lot of time in bars. I certainly didn't spend a lot of time staring at one through a filthy pickle jar. But something about this place seemed familiar. The arrangement of the tables, the diamond-patterned beveled glass window on the opposite wall, even the rack of wine glasses suspended above me like pendant lamps. A new shape moved into my vision. Someone even larger than the patrons and dressed all in white. "Get out!" Her voice was harsh and ragged, as if she spent her spare time gargling gasoline. "All of you, out! I would talk to my brother!" With a lot of grumbling, the crowd dispersed. The bar fell silent except for the sound of a TV somewhere across the room. A sports broadcast, a commentator saying, "Oh, would you look at that, Bill? His head came right off." I took that comment personally. At the far end of the bar, someone else moved, a figure so dark and large I had thought it was just a shadow.
"It's my bar."
His voice was a deep baritone, huffy and wet. If a bullwalrus could speak English, he would sound like that.
"Why do you always kick out my friends?"
"Friends?" the woman yelled. "They are your subjects, Thrym, not your friends. Start acting like a king."
"I am," the man said. "I'm going to destroy Midgard."
"Huh, I'll believe that when I see it. If you were a real king, you would have used that hammer immediately rather than hide it away and dither for months about what to do. You certainly wouldn't trade it to that no good..."
"It's an alliance, Thringa," the man bellowed.
I doubted this guy Thrym was really a walrus, but I imagined him hopping from flipper to flipper, his whiskers bristling.
"You don't understand how important that is. I need allies in order to take on the human world. Once I have married Samira Al-Abbas..."
"Bloop!"
I didn't mean to, but as soon as I heard Samira's name, I screamed inside my pickle jar, causing a huge bubble to break the surface of the greasy green liquid.
"What was that?" Thrym demanded.
The white shape of Thringa loomed over me. "It came from the pickle jar." She said this like it was the title of a horror film.
"Well, kill it," Thrym yelled.
Thringa picked up a bar stool and whacked my jar with it, hurling me against the wall and leaving me on the floor in a puddle of pickles, juice, and broken glass. I woke up in my own bed, gasping for air. My hands flew to my neck. Thank Frey, my head was once again attached to my body. My nostrils still burned from the scent of pickles and strawberry bubble bath. I tried to parse what had just happened, which parts were real and which were dreams. The dragon Grimwolf, Alex Fierro and her garrot, Loki burning his way inside my head, somehow using Uncle Randolph to get to me, his warning about a wedding in 5 days. All that had actually happened. Unfortunately, my dreams seemed just as concrete. I'd been with Randolph on his boat the day his family had perished. His memories were now tangled with mine. His anguish sat on my chest like a block of steel. His loss of Caroline, Aubrey, and Emma felt as painful to me as the death of my own mother. Worse, in a way, because Randolph had never gotten any kind of closure. He still suffered every hour of every day. The rest of the visions, Hearthstone and Blitzen coming to help me. I should have been elated, but I remembered Hearthstone's frantic signs. Too dangerous. Death. And the scene from the pickle jar. What the hell hame was that? Those mystery siblings, Thrym and Thringa, I was willing to bet 50 pieces of red gold and a falafel dinner that they were giants. The one named Thrym had Thor's hammer and planned on trading it for... I swallowed back pickle-flavored bile. For Sam. "It's up to you to bring the bride and the bride price," Loki had said. "An alliance. A one-time offer." Loki must have been out of his mind. He wanted to help us get Thor's hammer back by marrying off Samira? Why hadn't Sam said anything about this? "The poor thing is embarrassed," Loki had said. I remembered the urgency in Sam's voice when we'd talked at the cafe, the way her fingers had trembled on her coffee cup. No wonder she needed to find the hammer so badly. It wasn't just to save the world from invasion, blah blah blah. We were always saving the world. Sam wanted to prevent this marriage deal. But why would she even think she'd have to honor such a stupid trade? Loki had no right to tell her what to do. She was betrothed to Emir. She loved the guy. I would raise an army of Inharyar, magic elves, and well-dressed dwarves and burn down Jotunheim before I let them coerce my friend. Whatever the case, I needed to talk to her again, and soon. I struggled out of bed. My knees still felt worn and achy like Randolph's, though I knew it was only in my head. I limped to my closet, wishing I had my uncle's cane. I got dressed and retrieved my phone from the kitchenette. The screen read 7:02 p.m. I was late for Valhalla's nightly feast. I'd never taken so long to resurrect after dying in battle. Usually I was one of the first ones reborn. I remembered Alex Fierro standing over me, calmly slicing off my head with her garrote. I checked my texts. Still nothing from Annabeth. I shouldn't have been surprised, but I kept hoping. I needed my cousin's outside perspective right now, her smarts, her assurance that I could handle all the weirdness. My door blew open. Three ravens flew in, spiraled around my head, then landed in the lowest branch of the atrium tree. They glared at me the way only ravens can do, like I was not worthy of being their roadkill dinner. "I know, I'm late," I told them. "I just woke up."
"Caw! Caw! Caw!"
Most likely translation, "Get. Moving. Stupid." Samira would be at the feast. Maybe I could talk to her. I grabbed my neck chain and slipped it over my head. The runestone pendant felt comfortingly warm against my collarbone, as though Jack were trying to reassure me. Or maybe he was just in a good mood after an enjoyable date with a fine spear. Either way, I was glad to have him back. I got the feeling I wouldn't be using a practice sword for the next 5 days. Things were about to get Jack-worthy. Chapter 10. The Most Awkward Viking Luau Ever. As if Dragon Thursday wasn't bad enough, it was also theme night in the feast hall, Hawaiian Luau. Ugh. I understood that the management needed to keep things interesting, especially for warriors who had been waiting here for Doomsday since the Middle Ages. Still, the luau seemed a little cultural appropriation-y to me. Vikings were notorious for appropriating from other cultures, also for pillaging and burning said cultures. Besides, seeing thousands of Inheriar in Hawaiian shirts and flower leis was like getting a neon paint grenade between the eyes. The feast hall was packed right up to the nosebleed section. Hundreds of tables arranged like stadium seating, all facing the central court, where a tree as big as the Prudential Center spread its branches across the vast domed roof. Near its roots, turning on a spit above the fire pit, was our usual dinner. The carcass of Saemrimnir, the feast beast, who tonight wore a lovely necklace of orchids. Stuffed in his mouth was a pineapple the size of Wisconsin. Valkyries flew back and forth across the hall, filling pitchers, serving food, and somehow managing to avoid setting their grass skirts on fire in the tiki torches that flickered along the aisles.
"Magnus!"
TJ called, waving me over. His rifle was propped next to him, the broken stock patched up with duct tape. We didn't have assigned tables. That would have cut down on the fun of fighting each other for the best seats. Tonight, my hallmates had scored a great location on the third tier, a few rows from the Thane's table.
"There's our sleepy boy," Halfborn grinned, his teeth flecked with roasted Saemrimnir.
"Alucard, my friend."
Mallory elbowed him.
"It's aloha, moron."
She rolled her eyes at me. Alucard is Norse for fatso, as Halfborn knows perfectly well.
"Close enough."
Halfborn pounded his goblet to get the Valkyrie's attention.
"Some mead and meat for my friend."
I took a seat between Mallory and TJ. Soon I had a cold mug of mead and a hot plate of Saemrimnir with biscuits and gravy. Despite all the craziness I'd gone through today, I had a huge appetite. Getting resurrected always did that to me. I dug in. Sitting at the Thane's table was the usual assortment of famous dead people. I recognized Jim Bowie, Crispus Attucks, and Ernie Pyle, all of whom had died bravely in combat, along with Helgi, the hotel manager, and some other ancient Viking dudes. The central throne for Odin was empty, as usual. Sam supposedly received orders from the Allfather once in a while, but Odin hadn't appeared in person since the end of our quest back in January. Probably he was working on his next book, 5 Days to Your Best Ragnarok Ever, and the accompanying PowerPoint presentation. To the left of the Thanes was the Table of Honor. Tonight, it was occupied by only two people, Alex Fierro and her Valkyrie sponsor, Samira Alabas. This meant that, in all the 9 worlds, in the last 24 hours, only Alex had died a death worthy of Valhalla. That wasn't necessarily unusual. The nightly numbers ranged from 0 to 12. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling that nobody else had died bravely today merely because they didn't want to share a table with Alex. Two Valkyrie guards stood behind her as if ready to prevent an escape attempt. Sam's body language looked pretty stiff. I was too far away to hear, but I imagined her conversation with Alex was something like, "Sam, awkward." Alex, "Awkward, awkward." Sam nodding, "Awkward, awkward, awkward." Next to me, TJ pushed away his empty plate.
"Some combat today. I've never seen anyone do that. He drew a line across his neck, so quick and cold. I resisted the urge to touch my throat. First time I've been decapitated.
Not fun, is it? Mallory said.
What was going on with you, steaming and threatening to explode like that? I'd known my hallmates a while now. I trusted them like family. And I mean like Annabeth family, not Uncle Randolph family. I told them everything. Loki in his ghastly green tuxedo inviting me to a wedding, the dreams about my uncle, Hearth and Blitz, and the giant siblings in the bar.
Thrym!
Halfborn Gunderson picked some biscuit out of his beard.
I know that name from the old legends. He was one of the Earth Giant Kings. But it couldn't be the same guy. That Thrym was killed, good and proper, centuries ago.
I thought about Otis the Goat, who could supposedly reform from the mist of Gidingagap. Giants don't, like, resurrect. Halfborn scoffed.
Not that I've ever heard of.
Probably this is another Thrym. It's a common name. Still, if he has Thor's hammer... We should probably not spread the news that it's missing, I said.
Too right, Mallory grumbled. You say this giant plans on marrying...
Her finger drifted in the direction of Samira. Does Sam know about this scheme? I need to ask her, I said. Either way, we've got 5 days. Then, if this giant Thrym doesn't get his bride... He jumps on the telegraph, TJ said. And he tells all the other giants that he's got Thor's hammer. Then they invade Midgard. I decided not to remind TJ that no one used telegraphs anymore. Halfborn picked up his steak knife and started cleaning his teeth.
Don't understand why this Thrym fellow waited so long. If he's had the hammer for months, why aren't we already under attack?
I didn't have an answer, but I imagined it had something to do with Loki. As always, he would be whispering in people's ears, manipulating events from behind the scenes. Whatever Loki wanted from this weird marriage transaction, I was sure of one thing. He wasn't trying to get Thor's hammer back just because he was a swell guy. I stared across the hall at Alex Fierro. I remembered what she had said on the battlefield when we faced Grimwolf. He sent it for me. He knows I'm here. Mallory nudged me.
You're thinking the same thing, eh? Can't be a coincidence that Alex Fierro arrived in the midst of all this. You think Loki sent her?
I felt like the bathtub goldfish was wriggling its way back down my throat. How could Loki arrange for someone to become an Inheri? Oh, my friend. TJ shook his head. The combination of his floral-patterned Hawaiian shirt with his Union Army jacket made him look like a detective from Hawaii 5-0, 1862. How could Loki release an Elder Lindworm into Valhalla? How could he help Johnny Reb win the first Battle of Bull Run?
Loki did what?
My point is, Loki can do many things, TJ said. Don't ever underestimate him. It was good advice. Still, staring at Alex Fierro, I had trouble believing she was a spy. Terrifying and dangerous, yes. A pain in the loincloth, sure. But working for her father? Wouldn't Loki pick somebody who... blended in a little more? I asked. Besides, when Loki was in my head, he told me not to bring Alex to this wedding. He said she would ruin everything.
Reverse psychology, Halfborn suggested, still working the knife between his teeth.
Mallory snorted. What do you know about psychology, you oaf?
Or reverse psychology,
Halfborn wriggled his brushy eyebrows.
That Loki is a tricky one.
Mallory threw a baked potato at him. All I'm saying is that Alex Fierro bears watching. After she killed the Lindworm, with a little help from me, TJ added. She disappeared into the woods. She left TJ and me to fend for ourselves. Then the rest of the dragons descended on us out of nowhere.
And killed us, TJ said.
Yes, that was a little odd. Halfborn grunted.
Fierro is a child of Loki, and an Augur. You can't trust an Augur in combat.
Mallory swatted his arm. Your attitude is more offensive than your smell.
I find your offense offensive, Halfborn protested. Augurs aren't warriors, that's all I meant.
Okay, what is an Augur? I asked. When you first said it, I thought it was a monster. Then I thought maybe it was another word for pirate, like one who args. Does it mean a transgender person, or what?
Literally, it means unmanly, Mallory said. It's a deadly insult among big, loutish Vikings like this guy, she poked Halfborn in the chest.
Bah, said Halfborn. It's only an offense if you call someone Augur who isn't Augur.
Gender-fluid people are hardly a new thing, Magnus. There were plenty of Augur among the Norse. They served their purposes. Some of the greatest priests and sorcerers were...
He made circles in the air with his steak knife. You know.
Mallory frowned at me. My boyfriend is a Neanderthal.
Not at all, Halfborn said. I'm an enlightened modern man from the year 865 CE. Now, if you talk to those in Harriar from 700 CE, well, they're not as open-minded about such things.
TJ sipped his mead, his eyes fixed in the distance. During the war, we had a scout from the Lenape tribe. Called himself, or herself, Mother William.
That's an awful war name, Halfborn complained. Who would tremble in terror before someone called Mother William?
TJ shrugged. I'll admit most of us didn't know what to make of him. His identity seemed to change day to day. He said he had two spirits in his body, one male and one female. But I'm telling you, great scout. Saved us from an ambush during the march through Georgia. I watched Alex eat her dinner, gingerly picking pieces of carrot and potato from her plate. It was hard to believe that a few hours ago those same delicate fingers had taken down a dragon and cut off my head with a wire. Halfborn leaned toward me.
There's no shame in being attracted, Magnus. I choked on a piece of feast beast. What?
No, I wasn't...
Staring? Halfborn grinned. You know, Frey's priests were very fluid. During the Harvest Festival, they used to wear dresses and do some amazing dances.
You're messing with me, I said.
Nope, Halfborn chuckled. One time in Uppsala, I met this lovely...
His story was cut short by the sound of horns echoing through the hall. At the Thane's table, Helgi rose. Since this morning, he'd repaired his suit jacket and clipped his beard, but he was now wearing an oversized war helmet. Probably to hide the damage Alex Fierro had done to his dead buzzard hairdo.
In Harriar, his voice boomed. Tonight, only one fallen warrior has joined us. But I'm told the story of his death is quite impressive.
He scowled at Samira Alabas as if to say, it had better be.
Rise, Alex Fierro, and dazzle us with your glorious deeds.
Chapter 11. What's a guy gotta do to get a standing ovation? Alex didn't look excited about having to dazzle us. She rose, tugging at her sweater vest, then scanned the crowd as if challenging each and every warrior to a duel.
Alex, son of Loki, Helgi began.
Daughter, Alex corrected him. Unless I tell you otherwise, it's daughter. At the end of the Thane's table, Jim Bowie coughed into his mead cup.
What now?
Ernie Pyle muttered something in Bowie's ear. They put their heads together. Pyle brought out his journalist's notepad and a pen. He seemed to be drawing Bowie a diagram. Helgi's face twitched.
As you wish, daughter of Loki.
And don't feel obliged to mention my dad, Alex added. I don't like him very much. A ripple of nervous laughter went around the room. Next to Alex, Samira clenched her fist as if warming up her strangling muscles. I doubted she was mad at Alex. Sam didn't like Loki either. But if for any reason the Thanes decided Alex wasn't a worthy choice for Valhalla, Sam could get kicked out of the Valkyries and exiled to Midgard. I knew this because that's what had happened when she'd introduced me.
Very well, person who is the child of some parent.
Helgi's voice was as dry as Odin's empty eye socket.
Let us watch your exploits, courtesy of Valkyrie Vision.
These Vikings today and their newfangled technology. Around the trunk of the tree Laerdir, huge holographic screens winked into existence. Footage from Samira's Valkyrie body cam began to play. Sam was an expert at trigonometry, calculus, and aviation. So you'd think she could figure out how to use a camera.
Nope.
She always forgot when to turn it on and off. Half the time her videos came out sideways because she'd clipped the camera on wrong. Sometimes she recorded entire missions where the camera showed nothing but her own nostrils. Tonight, the video quality was good, but Sam had started recording way too early. Timestamp, 7:03 that morning. We retreated to a view of her grandparents' living room, a small but tidy space with a low coffee table and two suede sofas. Over the fireplace hung a framed piece of Arabic calligraphy, a swirling gold ink design on white parchment. Proudly displayed on the mantle underneath were pictures of Sam as a toddler with a toy plane, as a middle schooler on the soccer field, and as a high schooler holding a large trophy. As soon as Sam realized where the video had started, she stifled a yelp, but there was nothing she could do to stop it. The video pan left to a dining area where three older people sat drinking tea from fancy gold-rimmed teacups. One guy I knew, Abdel Fadlan, the owner of Fadlan's Falafel. There was no mistaking his mane of silver hair and that tailored blue business suit. The other two must have been Sam's grandparents, Gide and Bibi. Gide looked like Santa Claus or Ernest Hemingway,
barrel-chested and moon-faced with a snowy beard and lots of smile wrinkles, though today he was frowning. He wore a gray suit that had probably fit him 20 years and 20 pounds ago. Phoebe wore an elegantly embroidered red and gold dress with a matching hijab. She sat with perfect poise, like royalty, as she poured tea for her guest, Mr. Fadlan. From the angle of the camera, I guess Samira was sitting on a chair between the two sofas. About 10 feet away, in front of the fireplace, Amir Fadlan paced in agitation, running his hands through his slick, dark hair. He looked as dashing as always in his skinny jeans, white t-shirt, and stylish vest. But his usual easy smile was gone. His expression was anguished, like someone had stomped on his heart.
"Sam, I don't understand," he said. "I love you."
The entire crowd in the feast hall went, "Ooh!"
"Shut up," Samira snapped at them, which only made them laugh.
I could see that it was taking all her willpower not to cry. The video fast-forwarded. I watched as Sam flew to meet me at the Thinking Cup, then got a message on her phone for a possible code 381. She flew from the coffee shop and sped across the park toward Downtown Crossing. She spiraled down and floated over a dark, dead-end alley between two dilapidated theaters. I knew exactly where it was, right around the corner from a homeless shelter. Heroin junkies like to shoot up in that alley, which made it a great place to get beaten, robbed, or killed. At the moment Sam arrived, it was also a great place to get attacked by vicious, glowing wolves. Against the back wall, three large beasts had cornered a grizzled homeless guy. The only thing between him and certain death was a Roach Brothers shopping cart filled with cans for recycling. My dinner congealed in my gut. The wolves brought back too many memories of my mother's murder. Even if they hadn't been the size of full-grown horses, I would have known they weren't regular Midgard wolves. Blue, phosphorescent mist clung to their fur, throwing aquarium-like ripples of light across the brick walls. Their faces were too expressive, with human-like eyes and sneering lips. These were the children of Fenris. They padded back and forth, snarling and sniffing the air, enjoying the scent of fear coming from their prey.
"Back!" the old man croaked, jabbing his grocery cart toward the animals. "I told you, I don't want it! I don't believe in it!"
In the feast hall, the assembled Inheriar muttered with disapproval. I'd heard stories about some modern demigods, sons and daughters of Norse gods or goddesses who refused to accept their destiny. They turned their backs on the weirdness of the Nine Worlds. Instead of fighting when monsters appeared, they ran and hid. Some decided they were legitimately crazy. They took meds. They checked themselves into hospitals. Others became alcoholics or junkies and ended up on the streets. This guy must have been one of them. I could feel the pity and disgust in the feast hall. This old man might have spent his whole life running, but now he was trapped. Rather than come to Valhalla as a hero, he would die a coward's death and go to the cold land of hell, the worst fate any Inheritor could imagine. Then, at the mouth of the alley, a voice yelled, "Hey!" Alex Fierro had arrived. She stood with her feet planted apart, her fists on her waist like Supergirl, if Supergirl had green hair and sported a pink and green sweater vest. Alex must have been passing by. Maybe she heard the old man shouting or the wolves growling. There was no reason she had to get involved. The wolves were so focused on their prey, they never would have noticed her. Yet she charged the beasts, morphing as she moved and launching herself into battle as a German shepherd. Despite the size difference, Alex managed to knock the largest wolf off its feet. She sank her fangs into its neck. The beast writhed and snarled, but Alex jumped away before it could bite back. As the wounded wolf staggered, the other two attacked her. As quick as flowing water, Alex changed back to human form. She lashed out with her wire, using it like a whip. With a single flick, one of the wolves lost its head.
"Ooh,"
the audience said with appreciation. Before she could strike again, the other wolf tackled her. The two of them rolled across the alley. Alex changed to a German shepherd again, clawing and biting, but she was out of her weight class. "Turn into something bigger," I found myself murmuring. But for whatever reason, Alex didn't. I'd always liked dogs, more than I liked most people, and definitely more than wolves. It was hard to watch as the wolf tore into the German shepherd, ripping at Alex's snout and throat, matting her fur with blood. Finally, Alex managed to change form, shrinking into a lizard and skittering out from under her attacker. She turned human again a few feet away, her clothes in tatters, her face a horror show of slashes and bite marks. Unfortunately, the first wolf had recovered its wits. It howled in rage, a sound that echoed through the alley and ricocheted off the surrounding buildings. I realized it was the same howl I'd heard from across town while I fought the goat assassin. Together, the two remaining wolves advanced toward Alex, their blue eyes flickering with hatred. Alex fumbled with the sweater tied around her waist. One reason she wore it became evident. It concealed a hunting knife at her belt. She drew the weapon and tossed it toward the homeless guy. "Help me," she yelled. "Fight!"
The blade skittered across the asphalt. The old man backed away, keeping his shopping cart between himself and the battle. The wolves lunged at Alex. Finally, she tried to change into something larger. Maybe a buffalo or a bear, it was hard to tell. But I guess she didn't have enough strength. She collapsed back into human form as the wolves tackled her and brought her down. She fought ferociously, wrapping her garrote around the neck of one wolf, kicking the other. But she was outmatched and had lost too much blood. She managed to choke the larger wolf. It slumped over, crushing her. The last beast took her by the throat. She wrapped her fingers around its neck, but her eyes were losing focus. Much too late, the old man picked up the knife. He edged toward the last wolf. With a horrified shriek, he drove the blade into its back. The monster fell dead. The old man stepped away from the scene. Three dead wolves, their fur still glowing in faint clouds of neon blue. Alex Fierro, her final breath rattling in her chest, a pool of blood spreading around her like a halo. The old man dropped the knife and ran away sobbing. The camera zoomed in as Samira Alabas descended toward the fallen warrior. Sam reached out. From the broken body of Alex Fierro, a shimmering golden spirit floated up, already scowling at the unexpected summons. The video went dark. It did not show Alex arguing with Sam, punching her in the eye, or causing chaos when she finally reached Valhalla. Maybe Sam's camera ran out of batteries. Or maybe Sam intentionally ended the video there to make Alex look like more of a hero. The feast hall was quiet, except for the crackle of tiki torches. Then the Inheriar burst into applause. The Thanes rose to their feet. Jim Bowie wiped a tear from his eye. Ernie Pyle blew his nose. Even Helgi, who had looked so angry a few minutes ago, openly wept as he clapped for Alex Fierro. Samira looked around, clearly stunned by the reaction. Alex might as well have been a statue. Her eyes stayed fixed on the dark place where the video screen had been, as if she could make her death rewind by sheer force of will. Once the ovation quieted, Helgi raised his goblet. "Alex Fierro, you fought against great odds, with no thought for your own safety, to save a weaker man. You offered this man a weapon, a chance to redeem himself in battle and achieve Valhalla. Such bravery and honor in a child of Loki is truly exceptional." Sam looked like she had some choice words to share with Helgi, but she was interrupted by another round of applause. "It's true," Helgi continued, "that we have learned not to judge Loki's children too harshly. Recently, Samira Alabas was accused of un-Valkyrie-like behavior, and we forgave her. Here again is proof of our wisdom." More applause. The Thanes nodded and patted each other on the back as if to say, "Yes, wow, we really are wise and open-minded. We deserve cookies." "Not only that," Helgi added, "but such heroism from an augur." He grinned at the other Thanes to share his amazement. "I don't even know what to say. Truly, Alex Fierro, you have risen above what we would expect from one of your kind. To Alex Fierro," he toasted. "To bloody death!" "Bloody death!" the crowd roared. No one else seemed to notice how tightly Alex was clenching her fists, or the way she glared at the Thanes' table. My guess was that she hadn't appreciated some of his word choices. Helgi didn't bother calling a Vala, or seer, to read Alex's destiny in the runes like he did when I first arrived in Valhalla. He must have figured the Thanes already knew that Fierro would do great things when we all charged to our deaths at Ragnarok. The Inheriar kicked into full party mode. They laughed and wrestled and called for more mead. Valkyries buzzed around in their grass skirts and leis, filling pitchers as fast as they could. Musicians struck up some Norse dance tunes that sounded like acoustic death metal performed by feral cats. For me, two things dampened the party mood. First, Mallory Keane turned toward me. "You still think Alex is a legitimate Inheriar? If Loki wanted to place an agent in Valhalla, he couldn't have arranged a better introduction." The thought made me feel like I was back on Randolph's boat, being tossed around in 15-foot swells. I wanted to give Alex the benefit of the doubt. Sam had told me it was impossible to cheat your way into Valhalla. Then again, since becoming an Inheriar, I ate impossible for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The second thing that happened, I caught a flash of movement somewhere above me. I glanced at the ceiling, expecting to see a high-flying Valkyrie or maybe one of the animals that lived in the Tree of Labrador. Instead, 100 feet up, almost lost in the gloom, a figure in black reclined in the crook of a branch, slow clapping as he watched our celebration. On his head was a steel helmet with the face mask of a wolf. Before I could even say, "Hey, look, there's a goat killer in the tree," I blinked and he was gone. From the spot where he'd been sitting, a single leaf fluttered down,
and landed in my mead cup.
Chapter 12. Samira and Magnus sitting in a tree. T-A-L-K-I-N-G. As the crowd streamed out of the hall, I spotted Samira flying away. "Hey!" I shouted, but there was no way she could have heard me over the rowdy in Harriar. I pulled off my pendant and summoned Jack. "Fly after Sam, will you? Tell her I need to talk to her."
"I can do better than that," Jack said. "Hang on."
"Whoa, you can carry me?"
"For a short hop, yeah."
"Why didn't you tell me that sooner?"
"I totally mentioned it. Plus, it's in the owner's manual."
"Jack, you don't have an owner's manual.
Just hang on.
Of course, once you put me back in pendant form, you'll feel like I've been carrying myself through the air," I guessed. "And I'll pass out or whatever. Fine, let's go." There was nothing graceful about flying Jack Air. I did not look like a superhero or a Valkyrie. I looked like a guy dangling from the hilt of a sword as it shot skyward, my butt clenched, my legs swinging wildly. I lost a shoe somewhere over the 20th tier. I nearly fell to my death a couple of times. Otherwise, yeah, great experience. When we got within a few feet of Sam, I yelled, "On your left!" She turned, hovering in midair. "Magnus, what are you... Oh, hey, Jack."
"Sup, Lion Lady. Can we put down somewhere? This guy is heavy."
We landed on the nearest branch. I told Sam about the goat assassin lurking in Lairdor, and she zipped off to alert the Valkyries. About 5 minutes later, she came back, just in time to cut short Jack's rendition of "Hands to Myself."
"That is disturbing," Sam said.
"I know," I said. "Jack cannot sing Selena Gomez." "No, I mean the assassin," Sam said. "He's disappeared. We've got the entire hotel staff on alert, but," she shrugged, "he's nowhere."
"Can I finish my song now?" Jack asked.
"No," Sam and I said. I almost told Jack to go back to pendant form. Then I remembered that if he did, I would probably pass out for 12 hours. Sam settled on the branch next to me. Far below, the last of the dinner crowd was exiting the hall. My friends from floor 19, TJ, Mallory, and Halfborn, surrounded Alex Fierro and guided her along. From here, it was hard to tell if this was a congratulatory, buddy kind of escort or a forced march to make sure she didn't kill anyone. Sam followed my gaze.
"You've got doubts about her, I know. But she deserves to be here, Magnus. The way she died, I'm as sure about her heroism as I am about yours."
Since I'd never been confident about my own heroism, Sam's comment didn't ease my mind.
"How's your eye?"
She touched the bruise.
"It's nothing. Alex just freaked out. It took me a while to understand, but when you take someone's hand and lead them to Valhalla, you get a glimpse into their soul."
"Did that happen when you took me?"
"With you, there wasn't much to see. It's very dark in there."
"Good one," Jack said.
"Is there a rune that would make both of you shut up?" I asked.
"Anyway," Sam continued, "Alex was angry and scared. After I dropped her off, I started to realize why. She's gender fluid. She thought that if she became an Inherii, she'd be stuck in one gender forever. She really hated that idea."
"Ah," I said, which was short for, "I get it, but I don't really get it." I've been stuck in one gender my whole life. Never bothered me. Now I wondered how that would feel for Alex. The only analogy I could come up with wasn't a very good one. My second grade teacher, Miss Mangler, a.k.a. Miss Mangler, had forced me to write with my right hand even though I was left-handed. She'd actually taped my left hand to the desk. My mom had exploded when she found out, but I still remembered the panicky feeling of being restrained, forced to write in such an unnatural way because Miss Mangler had insisted, "This is the normal way, Magnus. Stop complaining. You'll get used to it." Sam let out a sigh. "I admit, I don't have much experience with..."
Jack leaped to attention in my hand.
"Argers? Oh, they're great! One time me and Frey..."
"Jack," I said.
His runes changed to a subdued magenta.
"Fine. I'll just sit here like an inanimate object."
That actually got a laugh out of Sam. She had uncovered her hair, as she often did in Valhalla. She told me that she considered the hotel her second home, and the Inherriar and Valkyries part of her family, so she didn't feel the need to wear the hijab here. Her dark locks spilled around her shoulders, and her green silk scarf hung around her neck, shimmering as it tried to activate its magical camouflage. This was a little unsettling, since every once in a while Sam's shoulders and neck seemed to disappear.
"Does Alex Fierro bother you?" I asked. "I mean, her being transgender? Like with you being religious and all?"
Sam arched an eyebrow. "Being religious and all, a lot of things bother me about this place.
she gestured around us. I had to do some soul-searching when I first realized my dad was, you know, Loki. I still don't accept the idea that the Norse gods are gods. They're just powerful beings. Some of them are my annoying relatives. But they are no more than creations of Allah, the only god, just like you and I are. You remember I'm an atheist, right? She snorted. Sounds like the beginning of a joke, doesn't it? An atheist and a Muslim walk into a pagan afterlife. Anyway, Alex being transgender is the least of my problems. I'm more worried about her connection to our father. Sam traced the lifeline on her palm. Alex changes shape so often. She doesn't realize how dangerous it is to rely on Loki's power. You can't give him any more of a hole than he already has. I frowned. Samira had told me something like this before, how she didn't like the shapeshift because she didn't want to become like her dad. But I didn't understand it. Personally, if I could shapeshift, I'd be turning into a polar bear like every 2 minutes and scaring the saber-mnear out of people. What kind of hold are we talking about? She wouldn't meet my eyes. Forget it. You didn't fly after me to talk about Alex Fierro, did you? True. I described what had happened on the battlefield. The dragon and the way Loki had invaded my head wearing an offensive tuxedo and invited me to a wedding. Then I told her about my dreams, and how apparently this marriage just happened to be Sam's to some bar-owning, walrus-voiced giant named Thrym, who served the worst-smelling pickles in Jotunheim. Some of this Jack hadn't heard yet, either. Despite his promise to remain inanimate, he gasped and cried, "You're kidding me!" at all the appropriate spots, and some of the inappropriate ones. When I was done, Sam stayed quiet. A waft of cold passed between us like a Freon leak from an AC. Down below, the cleaning crew had moved in. Ravens picked up the plates and cups. Bands of wolves ate the leftover food and licked the floor clean. We were all about hygiene here in Valhalla. "I wanted to tell you," Sam said at last. "It all happened so quickly, it just came crashing down on me." She wiped a tear from her cheek. I'd never seen Sam cry. I wanted to console her, give her a hug, pat her hand or something. But Sam didn't do physical contact, even if I was part of her extended Valhalla family. "That's how Loki is messing with your personal life," I guessed. "He came to see your grandparents, Amir?" "He gave them invitations." Sam dug one from her pocket and handed it across. Gold cursive on green cardstock, just like the one Loki had tucked into Uncle Randolph's pocket. "The incomparable Loki and some other people invite you to celebrate with them the marriage of Samira Alabas bint Loki and Thrym, son of Thrym, son of Thrym. When? 5 days hence. Where? We'll get back to you. Why? Because it's better than doomsday. Gifts are welcome. Dancing and wild pagan sacrifices to follow." I looked up. Wild pagan sacrifices? You can imagine how that went over with my grandparents. I studied the invitation again. The when section shimmered. The five slowly fading, turning into a four. The where section also had a holographic sheen, as if it might eventually change to a specific address. "Couldn't you tell your grandparents this was a prank? Not when my father delivered it personally." "Oh." I pictured Loki sitting at the Alabas' dining table, sipping tea from one of their lovely gold cups. I imagined Jeed's Santa Claus face getting redder and redder, Bibi doing her best to keep her regal poise while angry steam spewed from the edges of her hijab. "Loki told them everything," Sam said. "How he met my mom, how I became a Valkyrie, everything. He told them they had no right to arrange a marriage for me because he was my dad and he had already arranged one." Jack quivered in my hand. "On the bright side," he said, "that's a very nice invitation." "Jack," I said. "Right, inanimate." "Please tell me your grandparents were not okay with that," I said. "They don't expect you to marry a giant." "They don't know what to think." Sam took back the invitation. She stared at it as if hoping it would burst into flames. "They'd had their suspicions about my mother's relationship. Like I told you, my family has been interacting with the Norse gods for generations. The gods have this attraction to my clan." "Welcome to the club," I muttered. But Jeed and Bibi had no idea of the extent of it until Loki showed up and sent them reeling. What hurt them most was that I'd kept my life as a Valkyrie from them. Another tear traced the base of her nose. "And Amir." "The video we saw on Valkyrie Vision," I guessed. "He and his father came over this morning and you tried to explain." She nodded, picking at the corner of the invitation. "Mr. Fathon doesn't understand what's going on. Just that there's a disagreement of some kind. But Amir, we talked again this afternoon, and I told him the truth, all of it.
and I promised that I would never agree to this crazy marriage with Thrym. But I don't know if Amir can even hear me at this point. He must think I'm out of my mind.
We'll figure it out, I promised. There's no way you're going to be forced to marry a giant.
You don't know Loki like I do, Magnus. He can burn down my whole life. He's already started. He has ways of...
She faltered.
The point is, he's decided that he is the only one who can negotiate for Thor's hammer. I can't imagine what he wants out of the deal, but it can't be good. The only way to stop him is to find the hammer first.
Then we'll do that, I said. We know this guy Thrym has it. Let's go get it. Or even better, just tell Thor and make him do it.
Across my knees, Jack hummed and glowed.
It won't be that easy, Signor. Even if you could find Thrym's fortress, he wouldn't be stupid enough to keep Thor's hammer there. He's an earth giant. He could have buried it literally anywhere under the earth.
The White's Barrow, Sam said.
In Provincetown, I said.
You still think that's our best bet? Even with this goat killer stalking us, telling us it's a trap?
Sam stared right through me. She seemed to be watching the horizon, imagining a mushroom cloud rising from the nuke Loki had dropped on her future.
I have to try, Magnus. The White's Tomb. First thing in the morning.
I hated this idea. Unfortunately, I didn't have a better one.
Fine.
You contacted Harth and Blitz?
They're meeting us on Cape Cod.
She rose and crumpled up the wedding invitation. Before I could object that we might need it, she tossed it to the ravens and wolves.
Meet you after breakfast. And bring a coat. It'll be a chilly morning to fly.
Chapter 13. Relax, it's just a little death prophecy. Sure enough, once Jack became a pendant again, I passed out for 12 hours. In the morning, I woke with sore arms and legs, feeling like I'd spent the whole night flapping through the air with an inheri hanging from my ankle. Alex Fierro was conspicuously absent from breakfast, though TJ assured me he'd slipped a note under her door explaining where the lounge was for floor 19. She's probably still asleep, TJ said. She had a big first day.
Unless she's that mosquito right there.
Halfborn pointed to an insect crawling across the salt shaker.
That you, Fierro?
The mosquito said nothing. My friends promised to stay on high alert, ready to do whatever was needed to help stop Loki from holding his shotgun wedding in 5, now 4, days.
We'll also keep an eye on Fierro, Mallory promised, scowling at the mosquito.
I just had time to scarf down a bagel before Sam arrived and led me to the stables above the floor 422 exercise room. Whenever Sam said, "We're going to fly," I couldn't be sure what she meant. Valkyries were perfectly capable of flying on their own. They were strong enough to carry at least one other person, so maybe she intended to put me in a large tote bag and schlep me to Cape Cod. Or she might have meant fly, as in, we're going to tumble off a cliff and plummet to our deaths. We seemed to spend a lot of time doing that. Today, she meant riding a flying horse. I wasn't clear on why Valkyries had flying horses. Probably just because they looked cool. Besides, nobody wanted to ride into battle on a lindworm, flapping and bouncing around like a turkey snake cowboy. Sam saddled a white stallion. She climbed on his back and pulled me up behind her. Then we galloped out the gates of the stable, straight into the skies above Boston. She was right about the cold. That didn't bother me, but the winds were strong, and Sam's hijab kept fluttering into my mouth. Since hijabs represented modesty and piety, I doubted Sam wanted hers to look like I'd been chewing on it. "How much farther?" I asked. She glanced back. The bruise under her eye had faded, but she still seemed distracted and exhausted. I wondered if she'd slept at all.
"Not long now," she said. "Hang on."
I'd flown with Sam enough times to take that warning seriously. I clenched my knees against the horse's ribcage and wrapped my hands around Sam's waist. As we plunged straight through the clouds, I may have screamed, "Mainfurter!" My butt went weightless in the saddle. FYI, I do not like having a weightless butt. I wondered if Sam flew her airplane like this, and if so, how many flight instructors she had sent into cardiac arrest. We broke through the clouds. In front of us, Cape Cod stretched to the horizon, a parenthesis of green and gold in a blue sea. Directly below, the northern tip of the peninsula made a gentle curlicue around Provincetown Harbor. A few sailboats dotted the bay, but it was too early in the spring for many visitors. Sam leveled us off at about 500 feet and flew us along the coast, racing over dunes and marshes, then following the arc of Commercial Street with its gray shingled cottages and neon-painted gingerbread houses. The shops were mostly shut down, the streets empty.
"Just scouting," Sam told me.
"Making sure an army of giants isn't hiding behind the Mooncusser tattoo shop?
Or sea trolls, or whites, or my father, or..."
"Yeah, I get the idea." Finally, she banked us left, heading for a gray stone tower that loomed on a hill at the edge of town. The granite structure rose about 250 feet and had a turreted top that resembled a fairy tale castle. I had a vague memory of seeing the tower during my visit here as a kid, but my mom had been more interested in hiking the dunes and walking the beaches. "What is that place?" I asked Sam. "Our destination." A faint smile tugged at her mouth. "The first time I saw it, I thought it was a minaret for a mosque. It looks sort of like one."
"But it's not?"
She laughed. "No, it's a memorial for the pilgrims. They landed here before they moved to Plymouth. Of course, Muslims have been in America for a long time, too. One of my friends at mosque, she has an ancestor, Yusuf Ben Ali, who served with George Washington during the American Revolution." She stopped herself. "Sorry, you didn't want a history lesson. Anyway, we're not here for the tower. We're here for what's underneath."
I was afraid she wasn't talking about the gift shop.
We flew around the monument, scanning the clearing at its base. Just outside the tower's entrance, sitting on the stone retaining wall and swinging their feet like they were bored, were my two favorite people from alien worlds. "Blitz!" I yelled. "Hearth!" Hearth was deaf, so yelling his name didn't do much good, but Blitz nudged him and pointed us out. They both jumped off the ledge and waved enthusiastically as our horse came in for a landing. "Kid!" Blitzen jogged toward me. He could have been mistaken for the ghost of a tropical explorer. From the rim of his pith helmet, a screen of white gauze covered him down to his shoulders. The gauze, I knew, was custom designed to block sunlight, which turns dwarfs to stone. He'd also put on leather gloves to protect his hands. Otherwise, he was wearing the same outfit I'd seen in my dream. A walnut three-piece suit with a black bow tie, snappy pointed leather shoes, and a bright orange handkerchief for flair. Just the thing for a day excursion into a tomb of the undead. He tackled me with a hug, almost losing his pith helmet. His cologne smelled like rose petals. "Hammers and anvils, I'm glad to see you." Hearthstone ran up next, smiling faintly and waving both palms in the ASL gesture for yay. For Hearth, this was the equivalent of ecstatic fanboy screaming. He wore his usual black leather jacket and jeans, with his twister dot scarf wrapped around his neck. His face was as pale as ever, with the perpetually sad eyes and the spiky platinum hair, but he had fleshed out a bit in the past few weeks. He looked healthier, at least by human standards. Maybe they'd been ordering a lot of pizza while they hid out in Mimir's safe house. "You guys," I pulled Hearth into a hug, "you look exactly like when I saw you in the bathroom." In retrospect, that was probably not the line to lead with. I backed up and explained what had been going on. The weird dreams, the weirder reality, Loki in my head in a pickle jar, Mimir's head in a bathtub, etc. "Yeah," Blitzen said. "The capo loves to show up in the bathtub. Almost scared me out of my chainmail pajamas one night." "That's an image I did not need," I said. "Also, we have to have a talk about communication. You guys just disappeared on me without a word." "Hey, kid, it was his idea." He signed this for Hearth's benefit, pinky touching the forehead, then pointing at Hearth with two fingers. "Idea? His. H for Hearthstone's name sign." Hearthstone grunted in irritation. He signed back. "To save you, dummy, tell Magnus." He made an M for my name sign, a fist with three fingers wrapped over his thumb. Blitzen sighed. "The elf is overreacting as usual. He got me all terrified and hustled me out of town. But I've calmed down now. It was just a little death prophecy." Sam untangled her backpack from the horse's saddlebags. She patted the horse's muzzle and pointed toward the sky, and our white stallion buddy took off for the clouds. "Blitzen," she turned. "You understand there's no such thing as a little death prophecy, right?" "I'm fine," Blitzen gave us a confident smile. Through the gauze netting, he looked like a slightly happier ghost. A few weeks ago, Hearthstone got back from his one-on-one rune magic class with Odin. He was all excited to read my future, so he cast the runes and... well, they didn't come out so good. "Not so good," Hearthstone stomped his foot. "Blitzen, bloodshed, cannot be stopped. Before O-S-T-A-R-A. "Right," Blitzen said. "That's what he read in the runes, but... "What's Ostara?" I asked. "The first day of spring," Sam said. "Which is in, 4 days. "The same day as your supposed wedding." "Believe me," she said sourly, "it wasn't my idea." "So Blitzen is supposed to die before that?" My stomach started climbing up my throat. "Bloodshed that cannot be stopped?" Hearthstone nodded emphatically. "He shouldn't be here." "I agree," I said. "It's too dangerous." "Guys," Blitzen tried for a hearty chuckle, "look, Hearthstone is new at reading the future. Maybe he misinterpreted. Bloodshed might actually be
tool shed. A tool shed that cannot be stopped. That would be a good omen.
Hearthstone held out his hands as if to strangle the dwarf, which needed no translation.
Besides, Blitz said, if there's a tomb here, it'll be underground. You need a dwarf.
Hearth launched into a flurry of angry signs, but Samira stepped in.
Blitz is right, she said, signing the message with a hot potato fist bump, both index fingers extended.
She'd gotten good at ASL since meeting Hearthstone, just, you know, in her spare time between gathering souls, making honor roll, and flying jet planes.
This is too important, she said. I wouldn't ask you otherwise. We have to find Thor's hammer before...